and welcome to the final, we think, Albion Roar of the season here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we're still letting the dust settle, thanks to oldfootballshirts.com. Well then, this isn't the show we thought we were going to be doing this week. As the dust settled on our final day defeat to Manchester City, I think most of us were still in some sort of an emotional state following the brilliant send-off to our inspirational El Capitan, Bruno. So, when the news broke on Monday that the club had dispensed with the services of Chris Heaton, it was all a little bit too much for some of us to take in. But, gone he has. Whether it's the right decision or not remains to be seen, but all we do know is that when the first ball is kicked in anger in August, it will begin a new chapter. Joining me today as we look back on the last days of Chris, celebrate the career of Bruno, and look back at the season is, of course, Alan Wares. Andy Bash is with us, as is journalist, author, musician, and expert Albion manager sacked person, Nick Trepanic.
Yeah. I have to be here when a manager leaves. It's
the
law.
It's a great line on your CV, expert when Albion manager is sacked bloke.
Yeah. It's true. But,
Didn't want to be here.
No. But very pleased. No, we won't take it personally.
Love to be always enjoying it, but this is the circumstances.
But I said there a few times, probably. Now the dust has settled. I mean, obviously, this happened on Monday. We're recording this on Friday night. We still haven't appointed a new manager.
Well, let's look at last week. We recorded last week's show on a Wednesday, and we didn't even know Bruno was going. So we've got a lot to get through. So.
Yeah, Barber never told us that, did he?
He never told us, he never gave us this. Hang on, yes, he did. Well, actually, to be fair, I did get given the exclusive, but told not to tell. So, Should we start? Well, I think that the Chris thing is we'll do this in chronological order. I mean, we've got about the Bruno stuff because, you know, it was kind of not unexpected. But Andy, when you heard it, give us your first thoughts.
What, Bruno?
Bruno's announcement of his ending of his career.
Well, very much my reaction to the other news. Shocked and saddened.
Surprised?
Yes, I was, because I actually think Bruno's played really well since he's got back into the team. In the last few matches, and he looked like a player that still had something to offer. Maybe not every week, but certainly something to offer on the pitch. And certainly he provided a cool and calm head when we most needed it at the end of the season. And I think he was a key part of us eventually mustering those last few points to stay up.
And that's exactly it, Nick. I mean, he is a very calm head in that defence, and he does make a big difference.
Yeah.
Do you think he had something to offer?
A lot to offer. I think that, you know, people are so busy talking about the emotional thing of, you know, of him retiring and everything, but what a hole he's left in the squad. And of course, that other, you know, the great thing he has is leadership, and we have so sorely lacked leadership at times on the pitch in some games. And Bruno coming back, you know, he makes Duffy play better, he makes Knockhart play better. You know, he covers the back of the back four on his side so well. You know, I don't think Montoya's had a great season. I think he's come into a very different situation from what a fullback experience is playing for Valencia and Barcelona. I think he's been slightly freaked by it. Bruno, you know, brings all that steadiness and calmness. Admittedly, he sometimes slices the ball straight up in the air, like at Huddersfield, for example. But you know, what he does bring is so much more than, you know, any sort of deficiencies that he might have from being 38. Yes, I mean, we found out at the training ground, actually. We were there for the pre-Man City thing, and we were just suddenly told, by the way, Bruno's retiring. He's coming out to speak at midday. And interestingly, he was introduced by Liam Rossini, who put his head round the press room door and said, ladies and gentlemen, well, gentlemen, I give you Bruno. And Bruno took to the podium. But and, you know, there was spontaneous applause from
all
the press.
That's rare from the press, isn't it?
At the end, oh, yeah, no, that's reserved for special cases. And Bruno is a very special guy.
I mean, I was just about to say, you've been covering football for probably longer than us three have been alive. So, sorry, couldn't resist.
Not longer than me, Nick.
But, I mean, do you remember the first time you met Bruno?
Yeah, I try to remember if we met him before he had the beard, because, you know, he was just a brilliant fullback at that time. You know, he hadn't quite ascended to the sort of status he has now. I mean, he he came into it. I don't think he was made captain when Gordon Greer left.
That's right, yeah.
But, you know, I don't think it was a very difficult decision.
Mm.
But, you know, I've spoken to him a few times and, you know, he's one of those guys who's very friendly if you meet him out in the city, you know, or at the... I seem to remember he was buying something in the club shop. I'd have thought, you know, he just basically would just click his fingers and demand stuff. But no, and you know, just very pleasant, chatty, and you know, he's a.
So I mean, so over the 7 years he'd been here, I mean, you know, we've spoken to other people, we've interviewed him. So you know, in just talking to him one on one, I guess for you it was always sort of, you know, nothing less than a pleasure.
Oh yeah, well, you know, and there's a little bit of hero worship about it as well. You know, that's, I mean, my biggest hero worship moment was at the Spencer Vigna's book launch when I met Ian Goodwin and guys like that. But
yeah.
You know, Bruno is I don't know, he's can you be a legend while you're still there? No, he's a very, very civilized guy. You know, he gets what the club's about, but you know, he's not that people say, oh, he speaks great English. Well, you know, he speaks very good English, you know, for a Spanish footballer. I've met better, but, you know, but he's sort of respect for everything about the club and for his respect for the role that he's been given. You know, he takes the captaincy very seriously. And I think, you know, that sort of symbolic passing on of the armband to Lewis Dunk as he left the pitch, you know, those sort of things aren't done lightly because, you know, he gets the whole thing about, you know, the British attitude to captaincy, and he takes it all very seriously.
But, Nick, I mean, a few minutes ago you mentioned Bruno's leadership and the fact that that's been lacking on the pitch somewhat. Do you not think that Dunk is a natural leader on the pitch?
I know, having spoken to Dunk, so the book, that he liked Bruno as a captain because Bruno wasn't a sort of shouty type. I think Dunk doesn't like people shouting in his ear. He likes people who lead by example. So I presume he's going to be that sort of guy. I'm not entirely sure that that's what every team needs. I think we could have a few more shouters on the pitch. I don't want to go sort of old school, you know, completely. But I think there's one or two who you need to... you know, to remind people of their responsibilities on the pitch a little bit more. This, the leading by example is all well and good. There's photographs somewhere of Brian Houghton getting in Paul Clark's ear in a game at West Ham, I think, in our previous promoted to the top flight season. And that's a game we were drawing, I think, 0-0. And, you know, I just think that something a little bit like that has been missing.
Yeah. Some respond to shouting better than others. I mean, you know, I think, you know,
absolutely.
If you see, I mean, I'll tell you one player who is a baller on the pitch. I mean, Shane Duffy is certainly a baller on the pitch, especially when he feels that, you know, the team around him aren't again. It's kind of ironic that the Shane Duffy is probably the kind of captain that a lot of fans would want. In other words, that shouty Brian Houghton type character.
Let's
whereas
not
Lewis
forget,
Dunkey
though,
is
one. I mean, obviously, we didn't know this on Sunday, but we're going to have a new manager coming in. He might not want Dunkey as captain.
Well, absolutely. But the captain after Dunk is actually Dale Stevens, and Dale Stevens is another baller. And I've seen him berating players quite a lot. So there are people. Well, Basuma, knockout, believe me, you know, they've all been on the receiving end of Andoni, you know, at the end of the Arsenal game. Dale Stevens gave him a right earful. So there are shouters on there, but it depends on what the rest of the team want and need as a captain. And I'm perfectly happy with Lewis Duncan. I've seen him go up to referees and actually play that captain's role and be that one who's going to defend his players and fight their corner. And he could probably do that better than Bruno, because let's face it, I can't see Lewis Dunk being anything like the diplomat that Bruno is. So I have no problem. I know you've sort of mentioned this before. I don't have a problem with Bruno. I'm going to talk about the first time I remember seeing Bruno. And rewind 7 years. It was the pre-season friendly at Lewis. He came on in the second half. We didn't know much about him, apart from the fact he'd just come from Spain. And he was head and shoulders above everyone. And I remember the criticism was, well, we're only playing Lewis. Yes, we were only playing Lewis, but he was much better than everyone in the Brighton side. I mean, he was just, you know, and let's face it, Lewis, the pitch, even in the pre-season, is like, it's still like playing on the moon.
Yeah.
It's not a good place to control the ball, and he made it look easy.
Yeah. Well, I remember Bruno doing a little trick right in front of the benches when they were the other way round, so that The home bench was right in front of the press box. And I remember Poyet just sort of turning around, you know, with this look of utter amazement on his face at what Bruno had just done. And I'm thinking, he signed the guy, presumably he knew he was capable of that. But I think he'd surprised even Gus.
I mean, I've got a couple of Bruno stats here. Like, as you mentioned there, he signed it. It was 26th of June 2012. He made
for free.
Yeah, he made 225 appearances. He scored 6 goals, amazingly.
I thought it was more.
No, it was only 6.
Okay.
I thought it was only 2. But
well, we remember the one against Bolton, which was his first.
Away at Bolton in a 1-1 draw.
There was a sort of volleyed cross against Reading that dropped in. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah. I was going to say, wasn't there one belter? And I think that might have been it. Yeah.
No, it wasn't. I've got them here, actually. It was away at Bolton in a 1-1 draw.
No, his first one was a home one.
It wasn't. It was away at Bolton.
The one where they equalised in the 8th minute?
No,
the injury
that
time.
Wasn't his first one. It was away at Bolton. And the second one was away at Huddersfield, again in a 1-1 draw in April 14. Another one in a 1-1 draw at home to Cardiff. That was the one you're thinking
that's
of.
That's the belter, yeah.
Yes.
Another one in a 3-3 draw at Norwich.
There's a theme here, isn't there?
His fifth goal was a 1-1 draw at home to Wolves.
So every single goal.
His last goal for the Albion, which is on April 2016, was in a 5-0 win.
Oh, I was going to say. Other than that, Bruno scores lump on for the draw during the in-play betting.
He made his debut in a 3-0 defeat at Swindon. But I've got the team this day. This team had absolutely no right losing 3-0 at Swindon.
Hang on, we're talking about players like Jake Forster-Caskey and Rowan Ince and Teixeira.
No. The team that day, I've got it here, was Kushak, Bruno, Greer, Dunk, Bridge, Craig Noon, Liam Bridcut, Vicente, Ryan Harley, that's where it all falls down, Gary Dicker and Ashley Barnes.
Dicker up front?
And no, Barnes presumably was playing up front of his own. This is the game where Navarro scored twice.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember.
So they never actually bothered turning up that day.
It
was Bruno's debut and he's thinking, what have I done?
But I mean, what was your favourite Bruno memory, Andy?
You know what? I can't really pick out an individual moment. My thoughts about Bruno is just the way, not only just the way he played, but the way he handled himself as a rule. I suppose my favourite individual memory might have been after a game at Huddersfield away when I was with Phil and Louise. And
from oldfootballshirts.com.
We sort of hung around so that Lou could get his match worn shirt afterwards, and I just remember him being—he's so thin. I mean, it's just absolutely nothing of him, but absolute gent, and just the sort of player that makes you proud to support Brighton and Hove Albion. Mm. I mean, that was really it. I think, you know, every single game Bruno would be doing something. It'd be a little twist and turn, just the way he just like takes a winger out of the game.
Just moments of sublime individual skill. And his link-ups with Anthony Knockhart as well, particularly in the promotion season, were just wonderful.
I think for on-pitch stuff, as well as the tricks and swerves, I think that's probably the thing that he's going to be most remembered for, was his link-up play. And it's probably when we sort of appraise Knockhart whenever he goes, it's going to be his link-up play with Bruno. Yeah. So, you know, I fear for for Knockhart next season, as is going to have his kind of big brother not there, and I think that's going to be a huge miss. I mean,
he's not going to have Chris either. But I mean, it's like,
well, there's that. Well, I think that's a kind of a secondary consideration. If we have a manager that sort of like releases the shackles, then you know, then Knockhart could be having some fun. But he does need someone sort of playing alongside. It depends on how, you know, we might not have someone who plays four at the back. You know, so it's. I think it's the gentlemanliness and the respect and the dignity that Bruno has. And I'm going to ask this one for you, actually, the pair of you, bearing in mind that who is the bigger hero? Who is the bigger dude? Is it Calde or is it Bruno?
God, and they both competed for the same position as well.
And there's if only
one of them had been able to play left back.
And there is that lovely picture in the Reading tunnel of those two plus Rossini. And Calde retweeted, "We weren't fighting for the same place. It's just the competition made us play better." Yeah. Come on then. We've got radio
three right backs.
I don't know. It's a coin toss.
Well, just I think, lucky to have three dudes like that anywhere in the club, let alone in the same position.
Bruno was a better footballer.
Yeah. Who was the bigger dude is what I'm asking.
Calde, isn't he?
Calde was probably the bigger dude.
Yeah. It's
only the second footballer I'd ever seen on public transport.
The first one being Liam Dickinson.
Okay. Well, I mean, we'll leave Bruno there for now. He's just in his retirement interview, he actually mentioned that he's taking a British citizen test. So does that mean that he's actually going to stick around?
Well, the club wants him to, and he's umming and ahhing about stuff. And I think it's a shame we didn't actually. I was hoping to speak to Phil Shelley for this show this week, and I think he might have actually been able to give us an insight, because obviously the point that we're making here about Lou swiping his shirt, it's not as though she's sort of like a dirty stalker or just likes his laundry or something. They did sponsor his shirt for a long time. Don't worry, Louise isn't really Arnold Lane. But they do actually get to know. Sorry, that's a really old reference.
That's a reference.
Yeah. So, yeah, they did actually know, sort of Bruno quite well, and I would love to have spoken to them. But I'm just going to close with this, that I think appreciate Liam Rossini's comment best, is that when he said I left Hull to come to Brighton with a view to being the best right back in the Championship, and he said then I saw Bruno train and realised I wasn't even the best right back at the club.
Well, you know, Bruno, once a seagull,
always a seagull.
There we go. Now, one person who we were probably, well, I've said on other interviews that I got asked the question, did you expect to see Chris Hughton in the dugout in August? I said, yes, I do, but I wouldn't be surprised if he wasn't.
So now, you're not surprised by Monday's decision?
I was shocked. It's like having a long-term relative who's on their last legs. They're seriously ill.
Charming.
And you know they're going to go at some point.
Do you want me
point.
To edit this bit out
Chris,
and you do
Chris
it again?
Chris Hughton is older yeller. I mean, are we, but, he put I mean, out of his misery?
No, but
he's going to start singing Old Shep.
But, I mean, we knew it. I kind of had a feeling that...
Well, I think everyone had an idea. I mean, especially with the second half of the season, not many people do survive something like that. But let's face it, I don't think it's necessarily the decision itself. It was the timing. First thing Monday morning, you wake... Well, not quite wake up to it. You go into office and then you're basically... Well, you might
I got the email and it said Hughton. I thought, oh, they've extended his contract or something. And shocked but not surprised.
Yes.
And, you know, I think there's a lot of people. Could this have been dressed up as mutual consent, you know, with a couple more days to think about it?
Because it kind of makes it look knee-jerk, doesn't it?
People describe Tony Bloom as a gambler, but I think he does everything he can to take gambling out of situations.
Yeah. Mm.
He might be involved in betting, but I think he likes to make it as little of a gambler as possible. So he wouldn't have been unconsidered, that's for sure.
But it also seeks to presume, I'd like to think, that with all these things, and bearing in mind that the amount of criteria Tony Bloom does look at before making a decision, is that Plan B is in place already. Let's put it this way. As Paul Barber said on the show a few weeks ago, we have got to make considerations and contingencies for being in the Championship and being in the Premier League. And whilst he didn't say it or even hinted it, one of those would have been that looking at, are we going to be having a new manager? I cannot believe for a second that this was not discussed at board level at some point in the recent past. We don't know. We're not party to it. But I can't believe it hadn't have been.
No, you're not being professional if you don't have a contingency plan for every eventuality, you know, and the manager, you know, wanting to resign. Mm-hmm. You know, perhaps Chris Hughton would have felt, you know, he'd come to the end of the road, or he hadn't been a success and might have offered his resignation. The club would be, you know, in dereliction of duty if it didn't have a number of possibilities lined up. And I imagine, as they have with players, you know, there's a sort of cluster of a couple of or two or three possible names for every position. I'm sure there were a number of names for the coaching position if it came up.
Mm. But at the end of the day, Nick, we finished on 36 points, and that's not usually enough points to keep you up. And that and the form come the turn of the year has been absolutely dreadful. Just 3 wins in 23 games.
We stayed up because of Crystal Palace. I don't think there was anything we did that kept us up. We accumulate. We got 36 points, but I don't think. I don't think that should have been enough. I mean, we were Cardiff. Let themselves down with an appalling performance at Fulham, and then I think, you know, not really taking Crystal Palace's speed on the break seriously. So I think, you know, we were saved by other circumstances.
Yeah, Andy.
Well, I don't really know where to begin. I just think I was really surprised when I first heard it. Obviously, there have been whisperings. I'd heard people saying, like, you know, for a few weeks that Hughton's gone, whether we stay up or not. I chose not to believe that. But, you know, in the cold light of day, having watched that last few months of football, you realise that, you know, something wasn't working. You know, whose fault it is open to debate. I think it's six of one half, a dozen of the other.
Well, let's
suppose... I think we said on this show before that, you know, we think it's been a collective failure from both the players and the manager and coaching staff. But the thing was, from Tony Bloom's perspective, I think when he's watching that game against Cardiff and we're getting well beaten 2-0, and he's just seeing his, you know, £300 million investment just going down the plug hole. I think that is the, you know, when you're sitting in his chair, you are going to think, I might need to do something to fix this. And so, in a way, I'm not surprised. But
it's kind of interesting that he feels that it's specifically the management team. You always felt that if Hughton was going to go, then it has to be the lot, you know, and that includes Trollope and Levin, and they have gone. But as you just pointed out, it's, you know, Tony Bloom clearly feels that it's the management that's the problem here. Now, does that mean that he's exonerating the players and the recruitment staff, or, you know, is I suppose we're speculating here, but, you know, what's going to happen next on that score?
Well, managers are easier to get rid of than players.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's
the recruitment staff.
I mean, that remains to be seen.
Or quiet.
Well, it's not pointing. as Nick says, it's easier to get rid of the manager. It's easier to formulate a plan, and you kind of leave the players to the football people and in conjunction, because, like, you know, Tony Bloom is not football manager.
No.
He'd never pretend to be, but you know, that's what he pays other people to do. And for, you know, in his opinion, he didn't feel he was getting what he wanted out of the person responsible for that. So ultimately, you carry the can as a manager. You do. I mean, that is football. It's you know, it's not the most sentimental of businesses. It's, you know, it's very sentimental for us, but this is not an outrageous travesty of justice.
It's a very open question, Nick. But I mean, how much can you put down to the fact that we did spend a lot of money in the summer, and the fact that the new signings didn't actually particularly get bedded in or performed? Bearing in mind our recruitment has previously been decent.
What we've always heard from Chris is that no, we don't sign any player without his final agreement. So he's basically said that he's fine. He was fine with all those players coming in, but you have to question whether those players were used, you know, in the right way. If they were used in their best positions, in the best formations, you know, Ali Reza is always going to be the case that people throw up, you know, because he was used as a right-sided attacker, you know, in Holland, and has seldom played there at all. Lacardia, you know, who knows what his best position is, you know, and Gross, who's best as a number 10, has been played as a right-sided midfield player, where his lack of pace is shown up, you know. But you wonder whether Hughton was looking forward to a clear out of players, or, you know, some new signings this summer to maybe turn things around. But I think, you know, what went on in recruitment last summer, you know, is a big question, and who okayed some of those signings.
I mean, you have to also consider that the summer before, you know, there were a couple of decent players that we did actually get to sign. I mean, Scalotto didn't make a bad start. Pascal Gross was seen as a great signing, you know, for Tuppence Hapenny, and got player of the season.
And there have been some good. There were some good summer signs. I think
Ryan.
I think we all like Bissouma. I think Bernardo looks a tremendous signing. Mm. You know, had a bad start. But, you know, and the great mystery of Dan Byrne, you know, so when I thought we needed, you know, extra pace at the back, or, you know, a Joe Gomez type, we got another sort of tall centre-half. I mean, that's a slightly mysterious one. That sort of suggests that there isn't going to be any change in playing style at the back. But, no, it wasn't all bad. But, you know, major signings like Johan Bach, you know, a record, club record, That looks a strange one if he came in to play a position that he never played in his life before.
I think you also have to bear in mind that the scale, the size of the transfer fee is really is a red herring. And we've said this on the show before. The fact that Jacquembach was 16 million or whatever the figure that's quoted was, and Pascal Gross was 3 million, or one was a bargain and one was a flop. If it was the other way round, you wouldn't have actually said that Jacquembach was such a flop because he was only £3 million. It doesn't necessarily work that the size of the transfer fee is directly correlated with the quality of the player.
But even at £3 million, if Jacquembach was played as often as he was and contributed as little as he did, no assists, no goals, then you'd be asking why he's in the team ahead of Solly March. There are questions there. And, you know, let's be honest, some of the football has been terrible. Mm-hmm. That's not been advanced as a reason why Houghton was sacked. I mean, the results were the thing. Mm. But, you know, I've talked on social media about our identity as a team and how different it is from Poyet and Garcia when we were seen as a sort of front foot possession based team. And what are we now? We're you know, a footballing version of the Alamo. You know, everyone retreat and just repel all borders. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I presume that Tony Bloom thought that the possibility of watching that again for 38 matches next season, just hoping against hope we can hang on and, you know, hoof the ball down the field and you know, that someone like Andoni would run onto it and score. Well, you know, I think there's got to be more to it than that.
But just to play devil's advocate for a minute here. Now, obviously, if you look at the performance against Arsenal a couple of weeks ago, where the pressure was off, safety had always been secured, and we actually looked like we got our mojo back in that game. Now, if you rewind back to the turn of the year to the West Ham game, for instance, where we were 2-0 up, we weren't necessarily playing scintillating football, but we were playing decent football at that point. We had enough points on the board. We were looking comfortable.
To be fair, West Ham have finally woken up to us on that game.
It was that if we'd have won, hold on to win that game, and if we'd have won, I mean, ifs and ands, etc.
Pots and pans, you'd be
but
a kitchen.
But, I mean, you know, then the pressure may have been off for the rest of the season, and we may have been able to play that football that we played against the type of game we played against Arsenal, rather than the one against Spurs, where we just said, have the ball. No, we don't want it. Have the ball. Well, we don't want to score.
It's a situational thing. I mean, the Spurs game, I thought we played absolutely superb, and we could have got
at the back, yeah.
And we could have got an excellent point. But I think what that Arsenal game showed, and there are other games throughout the year, demonstrated that whatever anybody's reservations about the recruitment policy and the level of ability of our players, and I've always said, you know, I don't think this is a great team. I think it's an okay, decent bottom six team that's capable of finishing, should be capable of finishing fourth to bottom relatively comfortably, but not that much better than that. But what happened to that? But something happened to that team where the life got sucked out of it for four consecutive home games. It was an absolutely diabolical run of performances that were just like littered with terrible mistakes. And, the players played really badly in all of those games. The players were terrible.
Collectively.
And I'm pointing the finger at the players. But I know that those players are not that bad. They have played better before. They've demonstrated that they are better than that. And you know, you're sitting there in the chairman's seat, and you're just thinking, why is this happening? It is somebody's job to sort this out. And for one reason or another, Chris wasn't really able to sort it out with any great deal of confidence. And it's really sad, because I think, you know, this is been a bit of a negative chat about Chris, which I'm hoping we're going to turn it around, because basically Chris Hughton's been one of, if not the best manager this club has ever had, and he should be remembered for that.
Well, this is one thing that has happened. He goes and is with his stock still as high as it ever was.
Absolutely,
I think so. He didn't get us relegated. No. He kept us. You know, as Andy said, we're a fourth from bottom team. You know, as Kieran Maguire, a good friend of this parish, has told us many times, you know, we've got the third lowest budget. We still have the, you know, one of the fewest resources. You know, we're still only our, you know, we've just finished our second season in the Premier League, and as most other teams have had sort of like several seasons worth of budgets in order to buy decent players, and we've had to, we are back of the queue when it comes to getting the players that we want. So, you know, we are where we're at. And evidently, Tony Bloom is either frustrated or he feels that Chris has taken as far as he can. We'll never know whether that statement is true or not. But he's not prepared to take that risk. Okay, fine. We have to move on. But we are where we are. Yes, the next one, there's the possibility of it being exciting next year because we're going to have a bit more of a gung-ho type manager who's prepared to release the shackles. Or we could find someone who's an absolute clattering disaster.
Yeah, we'll win every game 4-3, of course.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine. But if we're going to really pay tribute to Chris Hughton and what he's done for this club, he took us in. And for the number of people who said, oh, he took us from near the bottom of the championship.
That is a red herring.
It is a little bit of a red herring. We know it. But, you know, hey, it looks good on his CV. Absolutely. And let's face it, first half of the season that he was, or the second part of that season is here. He didn't pull up any trees. But the real turning point for me was very, very early on in that season we missed out promotion. So his first full season. We were away at Fulham. Beautiful day. Beers on the Thames. And we turned up there against a team that admittedly we'd beaten the previous season, thanks to the brief tenure of Nathan Jones in charge. And we turned up and we were absolutely superb. I mean, it took a last minute penalty, but we were brilliant that day. And we absolutely took it to Fulham. And it was just that I'm thinking, actually, you know, there is something about this lot. They can play pretty well. And from there on in, and was it the first 22 games that season we didn't lose?
Yeah, we had two runs, one 22 game and one 21 game unbeaten, which was just spectacular.
And on the back of what had gone on previously, it was astonishing, and that was down to him.
I mean, and there's a lot of other stuff as well, Andy. For instance, his absolute stoicness about in the Shoreham Air disaster and his the way that he transmitted the club's thoughts on the whole thing. It was absolutely wonderful, and he, you know, he Chris
someone
Hughton,
wrote about it, didn't they?
Well, there is, but I mean, Chris Hughton, he came to Brighton. He immediately got the zeitgeist that is Brighton. Well, he understood the place.
He's a consummate diplomat. He's the perfect person to have in a situation like this. He is Brighton. You know, it's this the conversations on social issues that he talks about. The fact of the way he talks about Brighton, the city. The way he talks about his role. But then, not so Shoreham is that kind of one of those things. Nick,
I don't know if I'm breaking your confidence.
Go on then.
But I asked him when I was doing the book off the record about the freedom of the city. And he sort of hummed and hawed about it and said, yeah, great honour, great honour. And I say, you're thinking too soon, aren't you? He said, yes. He said, you know, we only got to lose the first three games in the Premier League. And, you know, the people who are giving you the freedom of the city now are going to be, you know, shouting, get him out. So I think he's very well aware of, you know, of everything. Another anecdote, he did something that I don't think... almost any other footballer, any other football manager would ever do. He approached a journalist and started talking to him when he didn't have to. This happened in the Hove Tesco when he sort of tapped me on the shoulder when I was sort of, you know, looking for cheap cat food deals and said, oh, hi, you know, how you doing? To be honest, he was with, you know, the wife and kids and probably wanted a bit of a break from the shopping, but they might have grandkids, I think it was as well. But Chris Hughton, the man. Absolute, total and utter respect, you know, as you say, the greatest manager in our history, simply because getting promoted was harder probably than it was under Mullery. But keeping the team there is probably harder because you're not, you know, Mullery wasn't dealing with such utter imbalances between, you know, the top and bottom in budgets. Chris Hughton, the coach, he's often been a safety first manager in the top division. But you look at his record in the Championship, won it, playoffs, automatic promotion. You know, so he's never failed to get to the playoffs in that division, and he's got automatic promotion twice. So you know, at Championship level, there isn't a better manager, and at Premier League level, never relegated. So, you know, sacked in 10th position with Newcastle, sacked, went out of the bottom three with Norwich after taking them to 11th, I think, and he's delivered us, what, 15th and 17th.
And it has to be mentioned that throughout Chris's time managing the Albion in the Premier League, we've never, ever been in the bottom three.
Mm. So let's ask a question we did of Bruno. Andy, do you have a particular favourite moment of Chris Hughton?
Was it the 1, 2, or 3 fist pumps?
The ones that, frankly, the FA should have actually had him over for.
I think actually, because he went really loopy when Andone scored against Huddersfield.
And well, is that Chris Hughton really loopy or Paul
but
Gascoigne?
No,
really?
But I just think there's like just. I mean, you know, he's you know, I mean, I love the sort of fist pump Mickey takes that we get of Chris. I went to the awards dinner in the promotion year. I was lucky enough to go to that, and we actually did get a couple of minutes with Chris. He gave us his time, and he was quite happy to chat to us for like, you know, 2 or 3 minutes. And just a really, really just a genuinely nice bloke. I think that was probably my favourite memory, because he actually just got to meet the great man himself. And he just confirmed everything that I thought about him, which was that he's a blimmin' nice bloke. And watching us play under him these last few years has just been so exciting. Mm. I mean, this year has been, I'm not going to lie, it's been an absolute grind. It was certainly responsible for me not going to as many far-flung away trips this season. I kept them all relatively local, apart from Man City.
Do you think
City.
He could have turned it around next season, Andy?
It's a million-dollar question. I think with this set of players, I don't think so. I think it would have required a major overhaul in the playing department. I mean, the playing department still needs.
I think everyone recognises it. The playing department needs, isn't it?
These meetings have all have been taking place about who's coming, who's staying, who he wants to get rid of.
But I love Chris Hughton. I've been defending it. You know, on this program, I've never said a bad word about him. I've always defended him, and I think he's been dealt a slightly dodgy hand to play with, but. Even I, like with my blue tinted glasses on, have just seen the ship starting to sink.
There comes a time when he's been there four and a half years, and players stop hearing anything.
Yeah, I walked. Yeah, after the car. I mean, we walked out the Bournemouth game, and we just kind of like laughed that off because it was just so ridiculous and so unrepresentative of what this team can do. But I walked out of that Cardiff game. I remember saying to like you both, Adi and Al, just saying, "He's gone.
Yeah,
he's gone." I was absolutely loathe to say it because
you put yourself in denial almost, don't you?
Yeah,
you think you can't. This can't be happening. Yeah. This isn't true. This isn't Chris.
But when you look back at what he's achieved, I mean, you're never going to forget that. You know, the promotion season, and to be honest, that even when we stayed up last season with the win against Man United, that was almost as much fun as the promotion day itself.
Actually, yeah.
I mean, he's given us two of those great days that as football fans, particularly as fans of teams that, you know, are not in the top six, this is why we go, and he's given us those moments.
FA Cup semi-final.
Also that, but not also he's not only made that leap from, like, say, that red herring of the poor Championship season.
FA Cup semi-final is a red herring in my book. I mean, you look at who we had to beat to get there, and, you know, that Millwall game was one of the worst performances
of
the season. And interestingly,
that's what the FA Cup's all about, though.
The fact that we got to an FA Cup semi-final, I don't think is that could have happened. You know, that just happened by.
So basically, what you're saying, it was like us getting to the JPT semi-final against Luton under Mickey Adams. Is that what you're saying? Like that,
well, I think was interesting.
Same result.
Yeah, exactly. The two home wins over Manchester United, fantastic. You know, that gave us, I think, three successive home wins over Manchester United in top
over
divisions.
Yeah, years.
No, it counts, mate. But I just thought our performances against some of the other top six teams, I mean, the way we sort of routinely lie down and prostrate ourselves in front of Chelsea. Mm. And then you see Cardiff having a real go at Chelsea and probably should have beaten them if it wasn't for, you know, a fantastic decision by a linesman, which we'll always be very grateful for. Mm. You know, that showed that there are other ways of playing against top six teams, you know, that possibly we'd forgotten about, you know, that we'd you know, that I thought that those Manchester United performances were the start of something, you know, a different approach.
Even against Manchester United away from home as well, actually. I mean, the game last season at Old Trafford, we were very unlucky not to come away with anything. And again, this season
was a good performance as well.
Absolutely. But thankfully, it was in both cases because it was under Mourinho. But no, I'm going to say this, you know, about Houghton, you know, sort of like the great days is like I say, it's not just the leap from like I say, that poor second half championship season into the near promotion, but it's actually the way that he can actually keep that squad together, that belief, that togetherness. And it was with the fans, it was with the club, it was with the players, it was absolutely everyone born. And I think he was pivotal in that, in actually making sure that we didn't crash and burn the next season, which could have easily happened. You know, this is a team which we said on the Roar at the time, I felt at the time, had overachieved in getting into the position that it had and failing on goal difference in the last game. I felt it overachieved, and I don't think we were quite ready. But the following season, we kind of had that second season of giving it another go. We're rubbish at playoffs, so let's go for automatic promotion. Let's go for it this time. And we really did. And we ended up blowing it, you know, typical Brighton, always the bridesmaid, blow it in the last three games. But the point is that Houghton got us up with four games to go. It was absolutely brilliant. And it was, I think it's down to him and the belief he instilled in the fans and the players and everyone facing the same direction. That takes talent.
See,
and
that's
one
of my biggest disappointments under the Houghton era, actually.
Promotion.
No, that home game against Bristol City. Where, I mean, it's partly the club's fault as well, I think, for actually making it look as if we'd already done it.
We did shoot our bottom.
I mean, you know, I mean, just to marry the two things together, I mean, that would have been absolutely wonderful seeing Bruno lift that glorious old First Division trophy.
Well, is that, to be honest?
I was desperate to see it. It was disappointing.
But I can't say it was one of the worst things, because, believe me, there were far worse.
But I would also just like to add, in sort of the great memories, it's just like how he handled that defeat against Sheffield Wednesday in the playoffs. Mm. You know, again, bizarrely another great memory, you know, for us as fans. It's just like the heroism of that side against the odds, the side in the first leg that literally just ran itself into the ground. I don't know how many players we had left on the pitch.
Well, Liam
Rossini
sort of addressing the fans at the end of the game.
Yeah,
he
steered that ship through choppy waters and nearly did it.
And also seeing Bruno in tears at the end of that particular game, at the end of the home game. You know, you saw them just crash to the ground, and I think Bruno was one. It was almost to think Bruno. I'm just wondering if it went through his mind saying that was my last chance.
Yeah. And like you were saying, I mean, like after such a crushing disappointment, such an emotional
against them of all,
and
people.
Such an emotional.
We've beaten 10 men the season after.
Yeah, after such an emotional end to the season, and how you did not achieve your goal, but then. To come back, get back on the bike, you know, just get back and do it again the next season, and then finish the job.
It's
just brilliant.
It's his ability to keep those emotions in check, though, isn't it? That's the thing. I mean, we've all seen other managers, you know, who dance on the touchline and much less.
Well, your doppelganger.
Dancing, perhaps. I don't know why that would. But see, if you talk about favourite Chris Houghton moments. The last seconds against MK Dons away.
Oh yeah, the penalty.
There's footage of that, moment of the dugout, and it's hells a popping. Absolutely everyone is going mental, apart from one man. This dark suited figure is absolutely immobile, staring out into the stadium, and then calmly turning around and walking back to the bench. You know, well. Calderwood and everybody, you know, doing cartwheels. So, I mean, that's Chris Houghton right there.
He did something very similar when Glenn Murray scored the winner against Birmingham last minute from the corner, when we'd been terrible for 75 minutes. Solly March came on, tore them a new backside, and let's say Glenn, then everyone again jumps all over him. I think someone jumped on Chris, and he was not having a bit of it. Glenn Murray did his fastest, longest run ever back to the away fans at the other end of the ground. Chris just stood there.
I've never seen him move so fast.
I think we got one fist pump out of Chris that particular time, and that was brilliant.
Beating Norwich 5-0 as well. That was always a good one.
Oh, that was a good one.
Yeah. But there's so many memories. I mean, like I said, we've said it before on the show, the memories that we had of that promotion season. I mean, you know, 2011 under Gus, it was absolutely fantastic. One of my favourite seasons, but so was 16, 17. You know, it was. And for the as for the open top bus parade, that is just something, you know, the day, the tens of thousands of people that were there, the duck egg blue sky, the it was just, you know, perfect. And that is the thing that I actually, of all things I want to remember about Chris Hughton and Brian Hove Albion, it's that.
Okay, and we're going to leave that one there. And basically, quite frankly, Chris goes with a massive, massive amount of thanks from Absolutely. Everyone, not just here in the studio, across Brighton, across the world.
Even those who feel he should have gone.
Yeah.
And I think it would be interesting, if he hadn't gone, I don't think there would have been a mass clamour that Tony Bruin would call it wrong. We'd still be thinking Chris will get it right.
I mean, people are still going to be talking about the timing for a long time. And it does... I mean, people would like to have given him a proper send-off, but, I mean, how many managers do actually get that? And how many managers leave a club like this?
Certainly found it, he certainly left it in a better place than he found it, so...
Absolutely, but, I mean, you know, he hasn't gone with, like you said earlier, with a relegation. He hasn't gone with failure. He's gone with 100% success with the Albion, and, well, apart from the FA Cup semi-final, what we'll talk about in a minute. But it was.
You're hard to please, aren't you?
I am very hard to please. Yeah. But you know, he goes.
Let's move it
at the right time.
Thank you, Chris Hughton. What can we say? Thank you.
Thank
Absolutely.
You.
And on that note, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are delighted as ever to be brought to you with a brilliant old footballshirts.com. And Phil, this isn't shirt of the week this year; it's shirt of the season.
Ooh.
So it's I'm just going to pass this across to Mr. Schapanik to describe
for
me.
It's like an old York City, but it's not, is it?
Okay, what we're looking at, a burgundy shirt.
Burgundy,
it might be 80s printer.
Perhaps it is. Is it a York City throwback shirt? Because they used to wear that, didn't they?
I remember they wore that Y-shaped thing.
Yeah.
I think when we bring 72, they wore the white with the maroon.
The reverse.
Yeah. Yes. The reverse of that. But that was their home shirt.
And it's like a jockey shirt. So basically, it's a maroon shirt with a big, huge Y that goes all the way from the shoulder down to the bottom of the shirt.
It's a giant pair of Y fronts, is what it is.
That is a banger, that.
That's a good shirt. It's really nice. Actually, it's the burgundy colour I really like. But, you know, yes, I remember that as being one of the first shirts I remember from my Rothmans football yearbook.
Does anyone but me remember a Hereford away shirt that was yellow with a big black H on it?
No.
It looked like bib and brass. We
you make it sound like one of the dungarees that they wore
on
rainbow.
Exactly what it looked like. But they wore it at the Goldstone, and we beat them 4-3. And despite the 7 goals, it's one of the worst games I've ever seen.
You make it sound like the commentary shirt that wasn't sponsored by Talbot.
Oh, bloody hell. It was the amorphous white blob as well that they had to wear for televised games because they weren't even allowed to wear the shirt without the Talbot logo.
But that is clearly a throwback York City shirt.
Yeah, and this is what Phil has to say about this shirt. He says, "This is your shirt of the season. I've just added this to my collection from a club I've always had a bit of affection for. This is the 2019 Bovham Crescent commemorative shirt, which
a what shirt?
The commemorative, which was. Which was to be worn by York City at their last ever game at Bovham Crescent on the 27th of April 2019, before moving to their new ground for next season. Now, unfortunately, sadly, a delay in completing the ground.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, no cheese room there. Means that they won't be moving in until autumn winter 2019, and so the shirt has been kept back until they know when the last game is going to be.
Okay.
The design is a throwback to the original York City Y front kit from 1974, which was also resurrected in red in 2002. They're known as the Minster Men, and they were originally formed in 1908 and have played at the 8,250 capacity, before it was bigger than that.
Used to be
Bovham Crescent since 1932. Anyone know what Bovham Crescent was before York City moved in?
I'm going to guess it had something to do with a chocolate factory, the huge chocolate factory that used to be there.
No, it was originally a cricket ground.
Imaginative.
Yeah. The new ground will be an 8,000 capacity all-seater stadium in the Monk's Cross area to the east of the city, and will be shared with the York City Knights rugby league team. York City's highest ever league finish was 15th in Division 2, now the Championship, in 1974-75, when they entertained teams such as Manchester United, Chelsea, Villa, Forest and West Brom. The majority of their history has been in the third and fourth tiers, but in 2004 they dropped into the Conference for eight seasons before a brief resurgence into the Football League. league. Sadly, due to off-the-field problems, they decided to tumble from the league and they now reside in the National League North, Tier 6. The club's all-time top scorer is Norman Wilkinson with 143. There is only one very fine association with the Albion. It's like this is Phil's all-time favourite Brighton player. Do you want to guess?
Go on.
John Byrne.
Yes.
Of course.
He began his career at York, making 175 appearances, scoring 55 times before he moved to QPR in 1984. So many thanks for that, Phil.
Is that the last crescent in the league to go? There aren't any other crescents.
Is there not a Mornington crescent?
I don't know. How'd you get there?
Rodney
Parade
is a good one.
Yeah, Rodney Parade. No, thanks for that. So I just want to say this. Phil has sponsored the Albion Raw for the past 10, 11 years, and continues to do so. Thank you very much indeed for your continued sponsorship. The reason that we ask for a sponsorship is that this is community radio. We're on Radio Reverb. We have a community radio licence as regulated by Ofcom. We're not allowed to advertise. We're not allowed to get money for advertising. We have to get it from sponsorship, from donations and from grants. So effectively, me and Adie have to pay to go onto the Albion Raw. Phil does that for us by way of a sponsorship. It's very generous and it allows us to actually waffle on air and have done for the past 10 years. Phil, thank you very much indeed for your continued support. Very much appreciated. And we'll catch you soon for a barbecue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, we've got a season review coming up.
I can't remember the good bits.
Well, there was
plenty of them.
There's lots of good bits. Now, if you listen to this on the radio, this will be carrying on over onto the podcast as well. Bearing in mind, we've just been talking for an hour. but we'll just quickly start. I've asked for the panel, and which wasn't meant to include Marcus Hancock today as well. Sadly, he couldn't make it in today. I've asked these five questions for your game of the season, for your moment of the season, your goal of the season, the individual performance of the season, and reasons to be cheerful. So what we're going to do, we're going to start with number one, and I'm going to tell you what Marcus's was.
Go on.
Marcus replied, number one, my game of the season was Palace away. Beating them in their own backyard is special.
It is. Always is. And it's about time we did so. I mean, it was something like 35 years since we didn't done the double over them, but I do revel in the fact that it's 86 years since they've done the double over us. So, but that was a pretty good day. Andy, what have you got, mate?
I've got the mirror image, actually. Although, to be honest, Marcus said my number two best game of the year. I plumped for Palace at home purely because I just loved the way that we just battered him in that game. Mm. There was no question about who was going to win that match. To be honest, there wasn't that a great deal of doubt in the away game either. But I thought the performance in the home game was just brilliant, and we just put them back in their box. And I loved the way we did it.
When
Balogun scored, we were all in despair. Oh my goodness! You know, Duffy's just got himself sent off. Oh, the slimy people are going to get themselves back into it. And then literally first touch of the game, wallop, back of the net, have some of that. And then just before half time, Bernardo, everyone's gone off for their half. You know, why people are leaving like a Brighton Palace game at half time for a quick beer, I don't know, but Bernardo boots it up, and Doné just like picks James Tompkins' pocket again, and just like wallop back at 3-0. What a moment! Fantastic, loved it. What a night!
Absolutely,
have some of that.
Devil's advocate moment again. Does Andoni score that goal if Tompkins hadn't already been booked?
Who cares?
go on then, Nick.
Either of those, yes. Funnily enough, though, I think the performance and the match where it really mattered was Huddersfield at home. I just think we were crying out for any sort of win. And I remember just looking at the team 20 minutes from the end when it was 0-0, thinking, have we got it in us to win this game? Mm. And at that moment, as I sort of looked up, Dale Stevens, I think, played a 1-2 and kicked the ball forward. And I thought, you know, I think they really believe that not only they got to win this, but they can win this. And I think that, of course, both Palace games were absolutely fantastic. And anyone who was at the 5-0 at Selhurst Park just loved that moment as that knockout shot kissed the inside of the post and went in. And Murray's reaction, if you've shown it, with, is priceless.
I'm not sure if it was shock or disappointment. You're supposed to pass to me. No, you can't not sort of choose the Palace game at home because, and I'm additional to Andy, we saw Albion at their best in both halves there. I mean, we absolutely sort of trolled them. I mean, Andoni's goal was probably the ultimate in trolling. And if you're right, if Tompkins hadn't been booked, then, you know, he wouldn't, but he had been booked and he could either get sent off, in which case we could have possibly gone on to get more, or is in the second half and I'm thinking, okay, we're 3-0 up, we've really got a bonus here. And I'm also thinking, we know how to defend against the top sides, against Manchester City for the most part, Manchester City against, you know, Spurs, you know, we can actually hold out quite a lot. Palace, in that case, if we do that and play that kind of defensive thing, yeah, it's going to be boring second half, no, we're not going to score. If only the only way that Palace are going to score against us is a penalty, which for the two that they conceded against us all season were both penalties. So, yeah, once it went 3-0 up, you thought, well, Palace are not going to get back into this. Ultimately, also, their fans thought it, which was funnier still. So, yeah, it's got to be Palace.
Oh, yes, them leaving at half-time. Hysterical.
Yeah.
It's always genius.
It was brilliant, yeah.
OK, well, my game of the season was none of those.
Go on, then.
It was a game that came after a performance of such ineptness we feared for our season, which was the first game of the season, which was away at Watford, which we lost.
Yeah, we were poor.
Lost 2-0. We were absolutely dreadful. We showed absolutely no hope. Actually, when Bissouma came on, he lit a spark a little bit. But we were a bit concerned.
Yes.
Particularly as we were looking at the fixture.
It was actually game that actually showed us the state of things to come,
yeah,
didn't it?
I mean, it was also a continuation of the away performances.
So what was your game of the season then?
So basically, after all of that, I mean, and looking at what the fixture list was coming up, we had Man United at home, then we had Liverpool away. So I'm going to go. My game of the season was that the Man United win at home, which was absolutely what a performance! Outstanding performance, great goals. Glenn Murray's goal in that game was
lovely goal,
which is it gets, you know, obviously we're going to talk about goal of the season later on, but the fact that impudent little dink over the keeper was just such a wonderful, wonderful thing. And
frankly, 3-2 flat of Man U that day.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
It's not much as delivery as well.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that was my game of the season. It was brilliant.
It was
Also, because it was the first game that I took my mother-in-law to, who is...
That's more than we want to know.
Which is... Well, no, she's, bearing in mind that Sue's 75, never been to a football game in her life. Managed to... She's definitely able, so she struggles walking, and she managed to get up all of the stairs to the West End upper. It was just
well,
brilliant.
I did actually. Now you mentioned it, I did forget that, and she said she found it easier to climb the stairs than descend them. So.
And I've got an absolutely wonderful picture of her and this person who'd taken their child, who was only 6 weeks old. So it was their first game, and both their first game.
Oh, brilliant!
And one at different ends of the spectrum. It was wonderful.
And also, I love the way that she buys the beers afterwards as well.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's always good. Okay, so we're moving on to the moment of the season. And I'll start with Marcus's first. Marcus's moment of the season was the Bruno subbed off in the last game to a man and even City applauded him off.
Well, all the City fans and all the City players did as well. Yes, and like I say, as Nick said earlier, just the symbolic handing over of the captain's armband.
You know what? That's a really good answer. And yeah, it's a shame we didn't get to talk about that a little bit earlier when we were discussing Bruno, because that was amazing. And I thought the class shown by the Manchester City fans and the Manchester City players was just exemplary and spoke very well.
They were in a position really to be magnanimous.
But they didn't have to. Yeah. I mean, they were in a position. I mean, they were in a good mood anyway. But it shows class. They did it. Yeah. You know, that's the important thing.
Yeah, if we'd been 1-0 up and that we'd been accused of adding on 5 minutes.
I thought for once Match of the Day got it right. They seemed to know who Bruno was and they acknowledged it. which I thought was very good as well. And yeah,
well, additional to that,
I think the teary moment for me was when he walked back on afterwards.
Yeah.
That was when the old waterworks started going.
Well, the thing about that additionally was the fact that we then returned the compliment to Vincent Kompany, gave him a standing ovation, and then Carl Walker went off. And we really didn't.
Well, he deserved it.
Well, yeah, I think it's not my moment of the season, but I think one of my funniest moments of the season is definitely politely applauding all the City players getting their medals and booing Kyle Walker when he got his, which I thought was very good.
Yeah, that was your moment?
No, it wasn't my moment.
Oh, what is your moment?
My moment is equally funny, but it is a football one.
Go on.
And it's Solly March's equaliser against Millwall in the FA Cup. It's just one of the most surreal things I've ever seen in my life. I remember turning to our good friend Vicky on the 83rd minute saying, we've only got 7 more minutes of this rubbish to watch
before
we go to the pub. And who knew? Like, you know, a few minutes later, we managed to drag ourselves into extra time. And, I mean, it was just extraordinary. I mean, it just came out of nowhere, sheer desperation, panic, and this is the sort of stuff when you watch other teams do it on TV in games, you go, why doesn't that ever happen to us? And this time it actually happened to us. We were that team.
To be fair, Cardia's goal was pretty good, though.
It was excellent. Well, but I barely celebrated that. I just thought it was a consolation.
Well, I'm going to go with my moment this season now as well, because I agree with Andy. I mean, mine was a completely different viewpoint. I was actually with you, Nick, actually. But it was I was there with myself and Nick were in the press box up at Millwall, which is a bit basic. Yeah. But perfect view. But I at 2-0 down with a few minutes to go, I had given up. I'd packed up my iPad, my notepad, packed up all my charges and everything. I put everything in my bag, and then all of a sudden there was a little fist pump when Lacardia scored, and then that moment that Solly just put that ball in the top corner by the help of the goalkeeper. It was just magnificent. It was just like that's what you go to football games for. That's why you're a football supporter, for moments of pure and unabated joy like that.
You see, I have a slightly different take on that whole Millwall game, because I was sitting next to Paul Jiggins of The Sun, who's a good mate of mine and a Millwall fan, and who sort of banged me on the shoulder at each of the two Millwall goals. And I desisted at the Lacardia goal. But, you know, as time was running out, I saw a little tear trickling down Jiggo's cheek, you know, as he was thinking, oh, we're going to Wembley for the FA Cup semi-final. So when we did equalise, I thought, oh, Jiggo, poor man, for a second. And then when I was sure that because their goalkeeper had made the mess up, that he was going to be the hero in the shootout, and I thought, oh, God, he's going to save Dunkey's penalty, isn't he? Well, no, he didn't. Dunkey's penalty was absolutely ice cool, and we know the rest. My moment of the season is Leon Balogun scoring with his first touch after coming on as sub against Palace, with Duffy just sent off. And for all we've said about Chris Hughton being a cautious manager, why he didn't send Balogun back to the halfway line with us having a corner, why he allowed him to go up into the penalty area. But hey, who cares why? You know, so from going, you know, a man down against Palace and thinking we're going to have, you know, about an hour hanging on with 10 men to our 1-0 lead, we're suddenly 2-0 up and flying.
It was a sublime finish, that, as well, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was just superb. It was a brilliant moment.
Okay. Well, there's also the fact there's the Palace fans who make their video diaries and what have you. And there is one bloke, and he does get a bit excitable. The bloke with the kind of the Steve Parish haircut.
Oh,
and
yes.
Yeah. He does get a bit, yes, it's a penalty. And he's screaming blue murder that it's a penalty, that, you know, brilliant. But, yeah, when Balogun does that, he said, he's only just come on and he's all alone. What's going on? I mean, I'm not going to repeat everything he said, obviously. But
I must go and look for that.
Yeah, it was hilarious. My moment of the season, I'm afraid we've already discussed it, actually. It's in the same game. I mean, it's just the way that you catch your breath with Andone outpacing James Tomkins, who, incidentally, would have been actually one of my contenders for the Albion Player of the Season. But no, it's that foot race. I mean, let's face it, as you said earlier, it was a Bernardo hoof into nowhere. And everyone else would have just said, right, that's it, off it goes, half time. And then we're sort of like legging it up the wing. and you realise that for the first time that we've finally got some pace up front. There's a little bit of assistance from Tompkins, you know, laying it back into Andoni's path, but it was absolutely beautifully finished with aplomb. And as I think the phrase is, limbs. So.
Yes, absolutely. Fabulous.
Well, absolutely. Well, it was. Okay, well, I mean, okay, we're going to move on to... I mean, it's an obvious one. It's goal of the season, but it
no,
might
not
be...
it's not obvious.
It might not be an obvious one. I mean, the Anthony Knockaert's one that's getting all the plaudits.
He mishit it. He didn't mean that.
Well, he miscontrolled. If he controlled that perfectly the first time when he got the first goal of the ball, I might have...
Arnholt might have stopped him.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, there is that. Yeah. But, I mean, well, let's go. I mean... Andy, what was your goal of the season?
My nomination is totally obvious because it is that goal by Anthony Knockaert against Crystal Palace. Because it was a spectacular goal, and he kind of saw, I think when he got the ball, we kind of wondered whether he completely got it under control, and then he just cut inside, and then from our letterbox view of the goal. From the side to see, and it just, it was again an air of disbelief that it had actually gone in. And again, I thought, we'd played really well. I was really annoyed that we were drawing. I just thought, no, that was justice as well.
Yeah.
That had been restored. And that goal I did celebrate. I mean, that was just like,
that was total limbs.
It's
the way the players came over as well. They were going absolutely.
It was absolutely brilliant. And, of course, who's going to score the winning goal at Selhurst? It's got to be Anthony, isn't it? And there's no one's going to steal that limelight from him.
And this is a fella who was lucky to be on the pitch.
Yeah, and, of course, it wasn't going to be a two-yard tap-in. It was going to be something like that. It was a special goal, a special moment. It was just one of the best.
It was a highlight of a very poor, otherwise poor season.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Al?
Well, the moment, I'm back to it again. I cannot get over Andoni. It really was that good. I think probably also the final whistle at after Manchester United. Last season.
That's not a goal of the season, though, is it?
Oh, sorry, we're talking goal of the season. the final whistle of the season. Yeah, the final whistle. I actually thought that, it didn't occur to me at the time because I thought that, it was just Murray being a 6-yard sniffer. But then you also get to realise when you see it, is the fact that De Gea was nowhere, and it was just so beautifully done.
Yeah, I mean Nick, what was your goal?
Michy Batshuayi for Palace at Cardiff,
which
was the goal where you thought, okay, that's Cardiff's own goal comeback. I mean, Shane Duffy at Huddersfield. I was going to mention it earlier, but there was a ball that was just travelling out, as far as we know, and Bruno somehow managed to hook it back in. We won a corner. Bruno took it before anybody else was ready to Solly March. And Shane Duffy must have started running as soon as Bruno took the ball over to the corner flag. And March's cross was perfectly into his stride. Just if you watch the replays, he doesn't break stride at all. He's running into the penalty area, takes off, heads it in. It's, as so much was perfect about that goal.
Timing as well.
Just before half-time, wasn't it? And if one small part of that goal had broken down, the goal doesn't get scored. Bruno chasing the ball, keeping it in, volleying it in, and having the presence of mind to realise that the short corner's on. Solly March was having a purple patch, striking the ball beautifully at the time. He must have seen Duffy coming up, and it's just the exquisite timing. I mean, anyone who's played Sunday League as a centre-back goes up for corners and, just risk getting their nose broke. We'll just appreciate the beauty of that, the timing of that run into the penalty area. Nobody spotted him. Nobody was ready for him. And Dunkel ran as well from the same distance, and he just was a slightly behind him and would have scored if Duffy hadn't. But that's my goal of the season.
Kind of shades of Virgo against Swindon, isn't
it? Well, I've got a couple of other important ones to throw you away. One of my other favourites was actually Glenn Murray's. Our first goal at Selhurst Park, which I thought was just absolutely stunning volley into the corner.
Anywhere else?
But another one of Glenn's goal, which was equally and subsequently massively important, as it turns out, probably was his last minute penalty at Southampton.
Yes,
which was
because I was going to put that down as actually as it wasn't. Weirdly enough, Southampton away in the second half was probably one of our better performances, and it needed to be, but you know, the first half was probably one of
that
the worst.
That was in our coming back from 2-0 down.
That's
phase.
The one,
yeah.
Yes, we did against Fulham.
But,
we?
And
yeah.
Also, I particularly enjoyed Lacardia's goal against Arsenal, which I thought was wonderful, that breakaway.
Absolutely. We also enjoyed Lacardia's at Millwall as well. It was a very good turn and finish.
I mean, I think there's a lot to come from Jurgen still. I think with the right manager, possibly.
Game against Derby, when he played down the middle, I actually saw him as a potential centre-forward for the first time. I actually thought he looked like a line leader in that game.
And also saw that Jackenbach played well in the West Brom game.
Because they didn't have so many defensive responsibilities, maybe. I mean, that's one of the criticisms that's been labelled at. In Holland, they never actually have to do much defending. We'll see. I mean,
if Brighton didn't have to do much defending, you get the Bournemouth at home game, so...
Okay, let's move on then to number four. Individual performance. Oh, actually, I think of you Marcus's goal. He was going around Donny Vee Palace, so there you go. Individual performance of the season, Nick Schrapanik.
Lewis Dunk at Tottenham. Absolutely. You know, if you saw about a man who didn't deserve to be on the losing side, Duffy and Dunk were both colossal. We spoke to Shane after the... he'd picked up the Best Player of the Season award, and he was just praising Dunk to the skies. You know, he's just talking about the guy on his left, and Dunkey turned up, actually just walked through the door as he was saying it. So I think he sort of moderated a bit, but you know, Shane had so much respect for Dunk's performance that night, and we're kind of used to seeing Lewis Dunk heading everything away. And I just think he took it to a whole new level on that night. you feel gutted for the whole team and for the fans when that goal goes in. But, you know, for Dunk especially, there's nothing else he could have done, I think, on that night. Okay. You know, if we got a point, he would have earned it, you know, more than anybody.
Sure.
Okay. Marcus's individual performance, where he said it's hard to say. So I'm going to go for the whole team v Wolves away to a man they stood firm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what's yours then, AD?
My individual performance of the season would probably... I'm struggling to, like... split them a little bit on this one. It's the same person, strangely.
I think Solly March. I was about to say, against Newcastle or against Millwall?
Or against Arsenal.
When
he came on at Millwall, he completely transformed that game. I'm going to go with that one because he was the one that somehow, by hook or by crook, got us to Wembley. And that was one of the highlights. That was got to be one of the highlights. The fact that the performance, I'd still got issues. I know you haven't, Andy, but...
You've always got issues, AD.
Oh, yeah, well, you know. It's got to be...
You even got grumpy on the... when beat Wigan, so... All right, Andy, what's yours then, mate?
Well, in complete contrast to Nick's, I've gone for Duffy at Spurs. I just think you could pin a tail on either of those and you're just going to come up a winner.
Yeah.
Pretty much pick a game, and it would be one of them, really.
Just extraordinary. And I agree with everything that Nick said about Dunk. I'm just saying it about Duffy as well. I just thought...
I just picked up because I think he played as himself and he played as Duffy as well because he did all the stuff that Duffy does normally as well as his own stuff as well.
Yeah.
And I suppose so did Shane, you know, a little bit as well.
I mean, you know, I would nominate the duo as the performance of a season. It was an extraordinary display of old-fashioned, of quality centre-half play. They kept Tottenham at bay. It took a very good goal from Eriksen to win it. They weren't create every single ball that came in was repelled. It was the Alamo. It was Rourke's drift. And it was just extraordinary to watch. And like, you know, I look at teams like Arsenal. Seriously, why are they not bringing like a big truckload of money down to the Albion, saying I'll give you 100 million quid for the two because that's what will make our team better. Because it would.
I was about to say
they're terrible.
You can't. But you can't. This is the point. I think is you can't buy one. You have to buy both.
Yeah.
You can't.
They just. I just think it's
they are the management, aren't they?
They are the best duo, I think, outside of the Liverpool outside the Liverpool centre halves.
Okay, so Duffy at Spurs then.
Okay, I'm going to
say, well, all of those above, but I'm also going to throw in a caveat of Bissouma at Huddersfield. I thought he
wound them up.
But to be fair, I mean, it's not as though he sort of like, you know, stuck a gun to Mounier's head and trolled, to, you know, got him to autograph his leg. No, but it's also the first time we really saw, I mean, we saw bits and pieces, but we saw him really sort of doing well against Watford on the first day, you know, doing everything that Gross wasn't doing. But, you know, he really put in a shift that day. And was it the first or second? He scored the second goal, didn't he? Did Bissouma score that day? Remind me.
No.
It was Andoni, but I think
he... Andoni got the winner.
But I think, you know, Bissouma was sort of really sort of dragging all the Huddersfield players around. So I'm going to say that one. And, yeah, probably pick for most games, not all of them, but for most games, probably pick Shane Duffy, who was probably, for, you know, for the first time in the 3 years they've been together, was probably the better of the two centre-halves. Mm-hmm. Although the players will probably say, well, did actually say it was Lewis Duck, mm-hmm. but, you know.
So only me going for a forward player then?
Well, it's a bit tricky to do so, isn't it?
We have a forward.
Yeah, quite. Well, the thing is, I mean, yes, you're quite right. I would have picked Solly March against Newcastle or Solly March against Mill. I think Newcastle, just because it was so much more important. You know, if we go out of the cup, fine. It's a bit embarrassing, but fine.
Yeah, I'll buy
but
that.
He actually dragged the whole team together, and actually that second half against Newcastle was how it should have been.
Okay. Okay, well, we'll finish off with the reasons to be cheerful when we come to the end shortly. But I just got a few other season stats, which I just want to throw at you quickly.
Do we want to hear these?
Maybe.
Oh, God.
Okay, I mean, the first one, interestingly, was there was a pre-season friendly at the Amex before the season started against Nantes. Notable because Emiliano Sala did actually play in that game. Which is, I believe, the only time he did actually play in England. I believe. I could be wrong on that. Okay, obviously, we beat Man United at home for the second season running. The score was 3-2, which was the only time we scored more than twice all season in the league.
Wow.
Okay. I've also got... obviously, we did score three times at West Brom, but that was after extra time.
Yeah.
And that was obviously in the cup as well.
So, that says something about Mourinho, doesn't it?
Yeah. Glenn Murray top scored again. He scored 15 goals, which are 13 in the league. This is one more than last season.
Uh-huh.
So excellent tally.
So that's an improvement.
I would suggest in that case, I'm going to need to look this up. I think he now, I could be wrong, I think he now equals Kit Napier's record of being highest goal scorer in most different seasons. I'll look that one up.
Okay. In 2017-18, we scored 34 and conceded 54. We had 10 clean sheets, 16 losses, 9 wins, 13 draws. This season, we scored 35, so one more than we scored last season.
Wow.
But we conceded 60. Only 7 clean sheets as opposed to 10 the previous season. Again, 9 wins, so that's the same. But most importantly, 20 losses, which is...
was it the previous season?
Last season was 16 losses. Okay. So we lost 4 more games. We had 60 yellow cards, 4 reds. 17-18, we had 54 yellow and 2 reds.
And would anyone ever argue with any of those reds?
Stevens at... No, I'm actually... No,
no you can't argue with Stevens on at Cardiff. So we had Stevens at Cardiff. We had...
Knockout
against Bournemouth.
Duffy
against Palace. Oh. And there was another one, and I'm sure that our listener will remind us while they're listening to it.
Yeah, I'll come back to
it in a minute, yeah.
Who was top of the assists?
I'm going to say...
Solly March.
No, I'm going to say... Dale Stevens.
Nick?
I think it might be Knockhart.
It was Antti Knockhart. Mm-hmm. He was top of the assists. He had 6. In second was Solly with 3 and Pascal with 2.
Mm. Wow.
Beautiful, isn't it?
Who made the most passes this season?
Dale Stevens.
Duffy or Dunk? Probably sideways to one another.
Probably Matty
it
Ryan.
It was Lewis Dunk. Uh-huh. He 14,000. Sorry, 14. And only one of those was forward. Now, No, it was 1,490 passes. Dale was second with 1,353. Shane, 1,305. David Prepper.
Who on earth bothers their backside to count this lot up?
David Prepper was after Shane with 1,213. Then it was Matt Ryan.
Going through the whole team.
No, I'm not going through it. Shots, Glenn 54, Solly 43, Shane Duffy 37. 12 different goal scorers this season.
Please don't name them.
Dale Stevens made the most tackles with 84, Eva Suma 62, Bernardo also 62, Montoya had 58, and Solly 56 tackles.
Wow.
Which says something about how we've been setting up, isn't it?
I'm pretty sure you can guess who topped the offside chart.
What, Glenn the entire continent?
Yeah.
So many who topped the fouls chart in the Premier League.
Yeah. Now, do they count it as fouls every time he's offside? Because obviously a free kick is given against him. Do they actually sort of, is that the same stats? I'd be curious to know that one. That every time they're offside and therefore gives away a free kick, that they actually count it as a foul. It's incredible. Glenn Murray would have easily surpassed Tommy Cook's record by now, by a long time ago, if he'd just learnt the offside rule.
Well, he was offside 38 times this season. In second place was Jurgen Locardi with 11. That tells you all you need to know.
Wow, that is some discrepancy.
Yeah. Massive stat coming up here. Ladies and gentlemen, we scored no own goals.
Wow. Extraordinary.
And did we have any scored for us?
I don't remember. But we had 108 shots on target all season. We scored 5 penalties. We hit the woodwork 6 times.
Hang on, did you say 108 shots on target?
Mm-hmm.
That's an average of nearly just under 3 a game.
Well, our shooting accuracy is 29% apparently.
Who does this? 100% regular from penalties.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And our passing accuracy was 75%. There you go. There's some stats for you. Okay, so reasons to be cheerful. We need some after that.
haven't seen the new kit yet. It might not be terrible.
Is it as bad as Southampton's?
Oh, isn't that appalling?
I haven't seen it. How appalling is it?
Oh, it's really bad. You don't want to see it.
Is it red and white stripes?
Sort of.
There are some.
If only that was all that was on it.
All right, okay.
I think they got Dick Knight to design the logo.
Yeah, I'll show it to you later.
Okay, please do. reasons to be cheerful. We're going to be assuming that with Houghton's departure, and we have to look forward, we have to sort of consider, you know, optimistically, because come August, you know, all negativity is gone, usually. You know, everyone's in the same position. We're above everyone else, nearly everyone else on alphabetical listing. So we're going to have to assume that there's the real possibility of more exciting football, even if it undoes us. That it's going to be interesting as to who the new manager is, obviously. And we also know that I'm really, really glad, for instance, that one of the things to be cheerful about is that we haven't had the usual betting of the usual carousel of Allardyce, Hughes, Pardew, Kerbishley and
Moisey.
As touted as the next people to take over. So there's one thing to be cheerful about. So, and I suspect also...
I Phil Neville's also been linked.
Yeah, but...
He's had some bad press. I spoke to him when he was Everton captain, and I think there's more to him than most people think.
And who appointed him as the England manager?
Dan Ashworth. Yeah, I mean, at the moment there isn't. Let's face it, it's been a slightly traumatic end to the season. And I think that we're all going to sort of like just appreciate the summer and sort of unwobble our heads a little bit. So I think that's probably a better question to ask at the beginning of next season, frankly. Sorry, mate.
OK, Marcus said, reasons to be cheerful. The Albion has never been in safer hands than with Bloom in charge. In Bloom, I trust, he says.
OK. Nick?
I thought my kit answer was... come back to us when we know who the new manager is. Yeah. But Tony Bloom's record appointing managers is pretty good. The semi-hippie one wasn't great. I'm kind of optimistic with Dan Ashworth being there as well, because I think clubs these days do need a technical director. I think the days of depending on whoever the manager was to bring in their guys and, you know, their team of mercenary footballers, I think that's in the past. I think you need someone to set the tone and identity of the football that's played at the club. And, under Gus and Oscar, we were we were a passing team. We've, as I say earlier, we've become the Alamo verging on the Titanic. I think we need to get back to a more positive team or club image. There were some unpleasant things said about the Albion's style and how we wouldn't be missed if we got relegated by people who, who don't know anything and only, see match of the day. But I think, if we get back to being more of a team that people find interesting to watch, I think that will be a good thing. And I think that there's every chance that will happen with the new manager.
Andy, reasons to be cheerful.
Reasons to be cheerful. We stayed up. We didn't blow it. It looked like we were going to blow it. And we bought ourselves another chance. By hook or by crook, we have survived. I think the scare was sufficiently serious that we're not going to paper over the cracks. We're going to try and do our best to fix them as well as we can with the resources that we have. But I like being in the Premier. I like being in the Premier League. I know a lot of people. Some people don't like it, but. I like playing the bigger teams. I didn't really enjoy some aspects of it this season because we did not play as well as we did in the previous season. But we get another go, and people can have a go at us for being miserable, dull, anti-football, whatever. We had to do what we had to do at the end of the season to try and get those points to stay up after we dug ourselves a massive hole. We did it. I don't think we should apologise for that at all. Because we're staying up and three other teams are not, and I'd rather be us than them. And so we go again, we've got another season to look forward to, and as of this recording, we've got no idea who's going to be leading us, which means all things are possible. And so in my head, it's all going to be great.
And obviously, three teams are gone, the three teams are coming back. We've got Sheffield United could be an interesting package. Oliver Norwood gets to play in the Premier League.
Well, Sheffield United, who are not spending any money because they're arguing about who owns the club. Norwich has said they're only going to spend £20 million, which I think is a great start, and I think they should be very much encouraged in that one. And then the third club that comes up has less time to sort itself out.
Which we know is obviously going to be Villa or Frank Lampard's Derby.
Yes.
Also,
could it be Frank Lampard's Brighton, though, come the end of the season?
No, I really hope not.
Also, like Sheffield United and Norwich, both near the station. both have good pubs, so that's been really good.
Equally, Villa and Derby. Right.
Yeah, and if Derby go up, they've got a cracking pub near the station. So let's hope they do it. Although Birmingham's brilliant as well. So pint.
We can only speculate on this one, Nick, really, at the moment. I mean, obviously, Graham Potter is the leading candidate. Everyone was going like, who, why, what for? But I mean, he's an impressive. He's got a very impressive record.
Yes, I mean, there's been an awful lot of ignorance talked on social media by various people who should know better about why are Brighton interested in a guy who's only finished halfway up the Championship. Well, if you look what he had to contend with and what the raw material was for that team that finished halfway up the Championship, I think he deserves a lot more respect than he's got from certain quarters. Other names in the frame, as I just said, my piece on Phil Neville, I think people will underestimate him. If Mikel Arteta is in the frame, then that would be very interesting as well. I understand Arsenal went a long way down the road of thinking about him before they went for Emery. You have to say that he's been with a fairly successful team and might have picked up a few tips from the guy in charge where he's been. As Andy says, I think it is all pregnant with possibility.
Absolutely. I mean, we at this stage we've got no idea, but obviously when we do hear, I'm sure myself and Al and probably Andy and Nick
we'll hit the airwaves whether you want us to or not.
So I'll only be here if he instantly resigns.
Or if he crocs a left back, that's it. But that's it. That's been this season. This has been the Albion Roar. Once again, thank you so much to everyone who's listened, contributed,
commented, moaned. Owned, bitched,
emailed, entered competitions, blocked, come to the live
off,
shows,
yeah, and everything.
It's been great fun. We'll be back again for another season.
Yeah, sorry about that.
And again, thanks for listening. I've been AD Packham. He's been Alan Wares. That's been Andy Bass. That's been Nick Trepanic. This has been the Albion Roar. See you again next season. Thanks. Bye.